Thank you. My name is Jenny Brodsky. I'm an epidemiologist in the STD control branch of California Department of Public Health. And today I will describe results of an STD and HIV/AIDS case registry match in California. I will begin with some brief background. There are strong biological links between STDs and HIV. People with STDs have been documented to be more likely to acquire and transmit HIV. There are also behavioral interrelationships between HIV and STDs. Among people living with HIV, an STD acquired after HIV infection indicates relatively recent high-risk behavior. There are a variety of reasons that matching case registries make sense to study co-infection. Traditional silo surveillance systems usually capture data for only one infection or disease. Yet in case registries, the data already exists, so matching is more efficient than a special data collection effort. In California, statewide estimates for HIV gonorrhea and HIV chlamydia co-infection are not available through current data systems. HIV syphilis co-infection estimates rely on self-report in the syphilis interview record. By matching, we can obtain STD HIV co-infection estimates for all three bacterial STDs and HIV that do not rely on self-report. So our goal was to match population-based HIV/AIDS and STD case registries for the state of California. This involved matching individually line-listed HIV/AIDS data to individually line-listed STD data. The next step was to examine demographic and risk profiles of co-infected individuals and identify populations with high STD/HIV comorbidity for action. The methods for this project are a bit complicated, and I'd be happy to speak with anyone interested in a lot more detail after the presentation. We used HIV/AIDS data from the HIV/AIDS reporting system from HARS. We aim to capture everyone who was diagnosed with AIDS through 2007, the first year for which we had complete HIV reporting data with names that allowed us to match was not until 2007, so we only have 1 year of data that includes HIV in addition to AIDS. We used chlamydia, gonorrhea, and primary and secondary syphilis data for the years 2000 through 2007. And because I needed to match on names and date of birth, I did exclude people who were missing any one of these data elements, which fortunately was very few people. We used a deterministic matching method. I used SAS and employed a procedure called PROC-SQL to help search for potential matches. Each record in the STD case registry was compared to each record in the HIV/AIDS case registry. Then SAS assigned points to each potential match based on the number of variables that were either exact or near matches. This is the rubric that we used to assign points. So near matches were allowed for first and last names to help capture true matches that weren't exact matches because of misspellings or nicknames. The combination variable is to capture names that are close but not exact, especially nicknames. So for example, a Mark Brown and a Marcus Brown would get full credit for last name and also for the combination variable. There were 110 total points possible, and then based on extensive manual review, we determined that a cutoff point of 80 points optimized sensitivity and specificity to identify true matches. Okay, I will now share results. These initial slides are only showing STD data. There's no match data yet. This graph shows the number of chlamydia cases in blue for males and females in 2007. More than twice as many female cases as male cases were reported that year. This graph adds gonorrhea cases in green. The balance between male and female cases is much closer. There were about 14,000 cases among both males and females in 2007. And then this graph adds primary and secondary syphilis cases in purple. There are very few female cases and many fewer male cases compared to male cases of gonorrhea and chlamydia. There were about 2,000 male primary and secondary syphilis cases in 2007. So now I'm going to show some of the match data. This stacked bar chart shows the proportion of STD cases that were HIV positive. HIV positive STD cases are shown in red, and the HIV negative STD cases are represented by the original colors. We see a higher proportion of co-infected male cases compared to female cases for each STD. It's a little hard to see for syphilis because of small numbers compared to gonorrhea and chlamydia. So we also looked at percent of STD cases that were HIV positive. Before, we were looking at count data. Now, among the same data, this graph shows prevalence. The y-axis is percentage of STD cases that were HIV positive in 2007. We see that HIV prevalence is higher among males compared to females for all three STDs. And among males, HIV prevalence among primary and secondary syphilis cases is much higher than HIV prevalence among gonorrhea and chlamydia cases. Okay. This graph compares HIV/AIDS prevalence estimated by our enhanced surveillance systems versus the matching algorithm that I'm describing today. In California, about 10% of all gonorrhea cases selected at random are interviewed and asked about their HIV status. Approximately 87% of primary and secondary syphilis cases are interviewed, and they are also asked for self-reported HIV status. So among the STD cases, the percentage that were HIV positive according to the match algorithm, indicated here by the red diamonds, was lower than the percentage that were HIV positive according to self-report in case-based enhanced surveillance, which is indicated by blue squares, for both gonorrhea and primary and secondary syphilis. We don't have case-based estimates for chlamydia. The estimates are in the same ballpark. Reasons for discrepancies include problems with dates in the HIV data that indicate that people were diagnosed with HIV after they truly were, based on dates given in self-report in the syphilis interview record, and minor problems with the matching code related to misspellings and other inconsistencies, such as different birth dates. Also, I did find people who self-reported as HIV positive in our syphilis case data who simply were not in the Office of AIDS data, or at least not by the end of 2007. These data can help us understand where there might be HIV underreporting. I will now present stratified data, beginning with race ethnicity. Among male gonorrhea cases, we see that HIV prevalence is quite a bit higher among white male gonorrhea cases compared to gonorrhea cases of other race ethnic groups. This stratification is by region of residence at time of STD diagnosis. HIV prevalence is much higher in San Francisco at 29% compared to other regions. Los Angeles is the next highest at 10%, and these data largely reflect HIV prevalence in these jurisdictions. Okay, now we will look at the data from the opposite perspective. I'm only showing HIV/AIDS data on this slide. There's no matching data. This graph shows the number of males and females in California living with HIV/AIDS in 2007. We see that the numbers are much, much higher among males. About 86,000 men are living with HIV/AIDS in California compared to about 12,000 women. So we're now going to look at STD incidence among persons living with HIV/AIDS in 2007. And this graph indicates that 1.6% of males living with HIV/AIDS were diagnosed with chlamydia, compared to about 1% of women. For gonorrhea, about 1.6% of males living with HIV/AIDS were diagnosed with gonorrhea in 2007, compared to only 0.3% of females. And just under 1% of all males living with HIV/AIDS in California were reported to have become infected with primary or secondary syphilis in 2007. Syphilis incidence was essentially zero for females living with HIV/AIDS. The difference in chlamydia incidence between males and females is smaller than the differences for gonorrhea and for primary and secondary syphilis. We now look at incidence stratified by mode of HIV/AIDS exposure. Gonorrhea incidence in 2007 was much higher among males living with HIV/AIDS whose HIV/AIDS mode of exposure was sex with men, designated here as MSM, or MSM plus injection drug use. Gonorrhea incidence was nearly 2% among those exposure groups, compared to only 0.3% among those with injection drug use exposure or heterosexual contact as their mode of HIV/AIDS exposure. Okay, and then this stratification shows gonorrhea incidence among HIV-positive males whose mode of exposure to HIV/AIDS was MSM, now stratified by race ethnicity. We see that gonorrhea incidence was higher among males who were African-American compared to males of other race ethnic groups. I do want to highlight, though, that while this rate is slightly higher among African-Americans, this disparity is nowhere near what we see for gonorrhea incidence overall in California, where the incidence among African-Americans is 12 times higher than whites. I will now transition to some observations about the process of carrying out this project. We have encountered some logistic challenges along the way, including that due to different data systems, STD data must be obtained separately from Los Angeles and San Francisco. In California, the HIV/AIDS and STD programs are not co-housed. HIV confidentiality laws stipulate that HIV data cannot be physically transported off the premises of Office of AIDS, which is based in Sacramento, so I travel there from the Bay Area for all analysis. And in addition, because the number of people living with HIV in California is high and STD incidence is high, the files have many records and require a lot of computational resources and time to match. One limitation of this match is that there are data errors and incomplete records in both case registries. Also, the determination of a cutoff point was challenging. Common names and inconsistencies in spellings and birth dates interfered with matching. It's also very difficult to assess magnitude and direction of bias in a matching algorithm like this. And we only have name-based data for HIV for 2007, which is not representative of all people living with HIV in California. And finally, this method only identifies people who are receiving care, and the populations most at risk for co-infections may not access care, making it difficult to accurately direct resources using these data. I will conclude with a few key observations, the first of which is that HIV/AIDS prevalence was much higher among male syphilis cases than gonorrhea or chlamydia cases. HIV prevalence was highest among male STD cases who were living in San Francisco and of white race ethnicity. In regard to STD incidence among persons living with HIV/AIDS, incident gonorrhea and chlamydia were higher than incident primary and secondary syphilis among males living with HIV/AIDS, and incident gonorrhea was higher among African-American males whose HIV/AIDS exposure was MSM compared to males of other race ethnic groups whose HIV/AIDS exposure was also MSM. In the world of STDs and HIV, the relationship between syphilis and HIV is frequently highlighted. These data remind us that in terms of numbers, more people living with HIV are infected with gonorrhea or chlamydia each year than primary and secondary syphilis. I would like to acknowledge the people who have made this project possible. And I would be happy to take any questions now and provide much more detail about the matching algorithm after the presentation. Thank you.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes for questions, actually, remaining in this session.
Excellent question. Right now, interviewing syphilis cases is still a very high priority in California. Our plans are for it to continue, and the interview record gathers many, many data elements that will likely never be available in a match. So I only shared a subset of the demographic factors we looked at, but there aren't so many more, whereas in the interview record, not only do we elicit partners that are then followed up with, but we gather many more data elements. So our hope is that both of these will continue, and it's really helpful to be able to have the two databases to compare to each other to see how we're doing. Thank you. Sure. A number of the conclusions that I presented were certainly things that we expected, like higher primary and secondary syphilis among, higher HIV in, prevalence among male syphilis cases. Those were things that we expected. I think that some of what we hadn't expected was to see smaller differences by race ethnic groups compared to our overall California data. So the disparities that we've seen both in terms of STD incidence and HIV prevalence among STD cases when stratified by race ethnicity were much smaller than we see for California overall. That was one thing that we didn't expect.
Any other questions? Okay, want to give one last opportunity for questions to all the other presenters. If there were any questions that were burning questions and you wanted to ask, we have about 7 more minutes left in the session.
I think that it hasn't been included, certainly not because it's any less critical, but because the data aren't as available. We actually do have a hepatitis surveillance focus within our STD control branch, but the quality of the data aren't at a high enough level to do the match right now. But I think that it's something that we would be interested in doing in the future. Oh, sure. Will this extend down? Or maybe we should push retreat. Okay. Oh, okay.
That's easier, right? It's a really good question. It's something we've been questioning ourselves about as to how we use this moving forward. How do we modify what we're doing in, especially in STD clinics, to accommodate what we now know from this project? And one thing that we found, there was one interesting study that was showing in the prison system, especially HIV counseling was having an effect on young MSM individuals who were released after release, were then brought in for repeated counseling sessions. So it was kind of a constant contact approach of, you know, counseling these people over and over again. And I thought that was something really interesting. Whether or not we'll be able to implement something like that is another question, but something like that seems to have worked in some settings, so I thought that was interesting.
Thank you. I will jump in and take a stab at that one, only because I tend to do that out on limbs. That's a wonderful question. What do we do to help to address this issue? And I think we have exhausted at some level the individual behavior change interventions, those that we have evaluated for sure, group level interventions as well. I think we really need to be looking at structural interventions now. And we have a very high burden of disease, both sexually transmitted diseases and HIV among MSM. And as long as we continue to have that very high burden of disease and can't seem to make the kinds of impacts we want on individual behaviors, Not that I would ever be fatalistic or lack hope, but I don't think we're really going to get there. One of the things we really do need to begin to do is to look at the population level effects of the interventions that we are deploying. Though we have this wonderful panoply of EBBYs, if we want to call them that, and among people who are presenting with STDs, we have a number of different modalities for managing partners. We haven't really focused so much on the behavior change as managing the partner. And it might be time for us to really start investing the resources needed in evaluating what could potentially be population level effects from some of our interventions. So it's a great question.
And I would just add, we actually have good information about date of STD diagnosis and date of HIV diagnosis. And one of the follow-up studies that we'd like to do is to look at whether these were co-diagnosed, what kind of settings they were diagnosed in, was there a big time period, large, many years in between date of STD diagnosis, date of HIV diagnosis, in an effort to get a better sense of how targeting these efforts could be most efficient.
Okay, a couple more questions. We'll start here, and then.
Comment rather than questions. Related to the earlier question about so what the value of some of these things. And some of them to me are hardly intangible. There's a lot of data that Rossi didn't have a chance to present that we learned as a result of this process. And the collaborations between HIV and AIDS surveillance activities and programs and personnel and STD surveillance personnel is a rich aspect to these activities.
Thank you. We had one more question.
You said Twitter just anybody looked at disclosure laws as related to high risk behavior, increasing standards, high risk behavior. Really, some research going on whether or not disclosure laws impact willingness to be tested. I'm wondering if there's any sorting.
I think that's a no. And one final question, because I think we're ending this session, or two more questions. Okay.
But what almost makes
Okay. Would anybody like to? That may be beyond the scope of their presentations, but let's allow an opportunity for a response if there is one. And, you know, and if I can just support the presenters, and I think that what they were presenting are co-infections and populations that are at risk for multiple infections. And the importance of that information is how do you then plan and strategize your prevention services within your respective program. And so those populations may be different depending where you're working, whether it's in California, whether it's in Washington State, or New York City, or Washington, D.C. So, you know, those syndemics or overlapping epidemics may look very different in each one of those jurisdictions. So a large media campaign, not difficult to say, but certainly targeted, more targeted prevention programs within these jurisdictions may be the so what factor. This is what we need to look at. Okay, one last question, and I think we need to wrap up. Thank you. Thank you for your comments. On behalf of our National Center and the Office of the Director, I want to thank the panelists for documenting the levels of co-infections. Terrific presentations, everyone.